Sounds True presents In Search of the Original Tree of Knowledge, a weekend workshop with Terence McKenna. Researcher, author, and philosopher, Terence McKenna has spent 25 years studying the foundations of shamanism and the ethnopharmacology of spiritual transformation. His books include Food of the Gods and The Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide, and most recently, The Archaic Revival. He is also the founder of Botanical Dimensions, a nonprofit botanical research project. In this weekend workshop, Terence McKenna examines time and its mysteries, the nature of language, and the techniques of ecstasy that have developed in non-Western societies to navigate to and from invisible worlds. And now, recorded live in Boulder, Colorado, In Search of the Original Tree of Knowledge, a weekend workshop with Terence McKenna.
How to slice into this pie? I try to never do it the same way because I don't want to get bored, but that lays a sort of obligation on me that I'm not always able to meet. Two things, I think, are going on inside this wrap as currently packaged. First of all, I'm very interested in talking about the impact of psilocybin on human evolution and values and institutions. And then, so that you don't think we've just fallen into fringe anthropology 101, I'm interested in taking the insights from that discussion and trying to apply it to the modern or postmodern, as the case may be, dilemma, trying to draw some implication from looking at human prehistory and the set of factors that were in place at the moment of human emergence. And since I feel pretty much among friends and fringies here, it doesn't trouble me to confess that my book, Food of the Gods, I really conceived of as a kind of intellectual Trojan horse. It's written as though it were a scientific study. Footnotes, bibliography, citations of impossible to obtain books, and so forth and so on. But this is simply to assuage and calm the academic anthropologists. The idea is to leave this thing on their doorstep, rather like an abandoned baby or a Trojan horse, and they will open their doors to it and take it inside, only to discover that out of this very staid rational discourse pour the self-transforming elf machines from hyperspace with their own agenda. I feel like I should say this, it's more for my ease than yours, that I reached the conclusions that I now espouse through skepticism, reason, rationalism, and tough argument. So it may sound ditzy, flaky, and soft-headed, but that's just because you're hearing it wrong. The guiding input was experience. And in a way, what we're gathered here to talk about tonight is an experience which is not only rare, transformative, challenging, but also, for reasons which we'll probably get around to, illegal. So it's a very peculiar situation. Very few experiences are illegal. And our models of the world are built up based on our experience. So if you make an experience illegal, you're essentially saying it is off limits for model building. You can't include that in your model because it isn't really there in some sense. And this is the situation in Western society vis-a-vis the psychedelic experience. To my mind, the psychedelic experience is as much a part of being human as sexuality, in personal independence, child rearing. These are the things which are scripted into us as opportunities for exercising our peculiar situation vis-a-vis the phenomenon of being. And a society which would deny that is a society whose secret, or maybe not so secret, agenda is the infantilization of its citizens. I mean, if we are not capable of dealing with these things, then who is? And are the people who made the rules, did they carefully, conscientiously, and at depth explore these dimensions and decide they were unfit for human consumption? Or was it done more hastily, more mindlessly, and with more fear? I would submit to you that it's the latter. Well, first of all, I want to talk about the impact of psychedelics, especially in this case psilocybin, on humanness. And then, if there's time, maybe we can talk a little bit about what is so great about it. I had a philosophy professor once, Paul Feyerabend. Some of you may know his books. And he opened his Epistemology 101 course by saying, I'm going to teach you what truth is, and then I'm going to teach you what's so great about it. Well, I won't claim to teach what the psychedelic experience is. That you will have to find out on your own. But I think it is legitimate to discuss what's so great about it. You know, are we, by any measurable index, superior or inferior to people who do not have this experience? Because if not, then really the psychedelic position is no more than a kind of cult to be lined up along with Roman Catholicism and all the other cults out there. Speaking as a former member, of course. Well, my notion of the way to legitimate the importance of psychedelics is by showing, and I think one can show in fairly short order, that these things are not alien to the human experience or ancillary or the province of uneducated little brown people down in the rainforest or anything like that. I submit to you that the psychedelic experience and the impact of psychedelic plants on human beings is central to understanding who we are and how we got this way. And if we can explore this issue and convince ourselves that there's some merit in this point of view, then it will do more than rewrite the annals of a staid science like anthropology. It will actually change how we relate to each other and to the planet that we're in the process of grinding into pollution. So that's the raison d'etre for the politics behind it. Now, here's the spiel. Sometime in the last 3 million years, the our remote ancestors, the proto-hominids, were disrupted in their evolutionary climax in the canopies of the great rainforests of Africa. You see, most animal species evolve into a niche, tighter and tighter and tighter. We see this with termites and cockroaches and most life forms. This is what happens to them. Only if the niche is somehow disrupted or destroyed does the game veer away from its tendency toward closure. And this is what happened to us. Our remote ancestors would have lived happily in the climaxed rainforests of Africa, in the same way that primates to this day live happily in the climaxed rainforests of Indonesia and South America, but for the fact that the dynamics of the planet, and this ultimately is, if we're looking for a cause, or some people would say a villain, then it's the climatological dynamics of the planet which began to limit these rainforest habitats. And a new kind of habitat began to form in Africa, which was grassland. It's very recent. And under nutritional pressure, and under a pressure that was the result of this retreating environment, our remote ancestors descended from the trees and began to adapt themselves to the new world of the grassland. And they did this over a period of probably a couple of million years. Now, I maintain, and if any of you are evolutionary biologists or anthropologists, this is the nub of my position. Here's what's new scientifically. What they teach you about evolution is that it's caused by mutation, which is a random process, which then meets another random process, which is natural selection. And out of these two random processes, lo and behold, you get sea urchins, birds of paradise, gray whales, and human beings. Now, when you inquire as to what is the source of this mutation, you will be told it's cosmic rays, incident incoming hard radiation, which can disrupt chromosomes, and then most of these mutations are lethal, some huge percentage of them, but a vanishingly small number of them actually confer adaptive advantage, and they are then preserved in the genome and passed on. Now, what I want to suggest, and I've never seen it thoroughly treated by evolutionary thinkers, is that food is the unexamined source of evolutionary pressure. It can be. If you know anything about animal species, you know that most animals tend to specialize their diet. Insects are famous for this. If you find a caterpillar and you want to raise it in a jar, you must give it the food plant you found it on, because they don't just eat leaves. It doesn't work like that. They have species-specific adaptations. Now, why is this? It's because it's a strategy to limit exposure to toxic and mutagenic chemicals that other life forms are sequestering in their tissue to discourage predation, essentially. Well, so then what happens when a animal population, such as our remote ancestors, comes under pressure from a dwindling habitat or a limited availability of food? Well, what happens, if you have any sense, is you start experimenting. You start digging up roots you never thought about before and chewing on them. You start eating leaves. You start eating insect protein. You experiment with the slaughter of small animals and so forth and so on. And this is precisely what our remote ancestors did. This is the much lamented transition from fruititarian holiness to predatory carnivorous messiness. But had we not been willing to lower our gourmet standards, we would have entered the fossil record at that point. So here we have these proto-hominids foraging into this new grassland environment, beginning to beat on prairie dogs and stuff like that. And simultaneously, as we all know, evolving in this African veldt environment were great herds of ungulate animals, proto-cattle, bison, wildebeest, antelopes, many, many different kinds of animals. And one of the curiosities of nature is that many mushrooms prefer the dung of ungulate animals to just going out and making a deal with the raw natural environment. They like the leavening that goes on with vegetable material when it passes through the double stomach of an ungulate animal. As a headline, what this means is mushrooms grow in manure. And so our remote ancestors, testing for insects and eating small animals, would certainly have encountered the so-called coprophytic or coprophilic, the dung-loving mushrooms. And they would have tested them for food. Years ago, when I was in Kenya, I observed baboon troops in this very environment we're discussing, and their habit was they were very interested in cow pies because they had learned from experience that if you rush over to a relatively old cow pie and flip it over, there's a high probability of beetles or beetle grubs under there, and so these were vectors for food getting. Well, in the I did not observe mushrooms in Africa, but I observed mushrooms in the Amazon, and they can attain the size of a dinner plate. I've never seen them in cultivation quite that large. But, you know, you come out after a hard rain, and these things are landed like little flying saucers or frisbees in the meadows. They would certainly have been tested for their nutritional potential. And psilocybin, different from all other chemicals in nature, including, as far as I can tell, all other hallucinogenic chemicals in nature, psilocybin has a unique set of characteristics which implicate it, to my mind, very strongly in the catalyzing of the emergence of humanness out of proto-hominid and hominid organization. And it works like this. It's very relatively easy to understand as major scientific breakthroughs go. At least you're not going to be asked to do any partial differential equations this evening. Psilocybin, in very low doses so low that if you were to take a dose this low, you could conceivably forget you had done it and just go out and shop and fiddle around. But at doses so low that they do not register as a psychedelic experience, psilocybin imparts measurable improvement in visual acuity. Roland Fisher did this work in the late 50s and early 60s, and they built an experimental device where a person who could not be seen, by turning a crank, there were two parallel bars, and by turning a crank, this person could rotate one of the parallel bars so that it was no longer parallel. And lacking talking rats, they went to the next preferred experimental animal, which is graduate students. And they would sit a graduate student down in front of this device, give them a very low dose of psilocybin, and then put a buzzer in their hand and say, when the two bars are no longer parallel, push the buzzer. And Fisher collected large amounts of data which showed that the people who had taken the psilocybin, and the other people were given placebo, of course, could detect this deformation long before the unstoned subjects were able to do so. And Fisher, who was a totally straight European scientist, in fact a Viennese-er, when I talked to him about this stuff, he was very cagey, and he was funny, in fact. He said, well, you see, it's very interesting. Apparently here we have data which argues significantly that we are perceiving reality better with the drug than without the drug. Yes, Yes. For him, that was a joke. I mean, he never did anything with it. It was just a throwaway line. But it stuck with me. And I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to see that if you are a hunting animal in a situation of nutritional pressure, as our remote ancestors were, and there is a food in that environment which will give you better vision, then by God, the animals which accept that item into their diet are going to be more successful hunters than the ones that do not. And consequently, they will outbreed those members of the population that have some aversion to this exotic food. Either they don't like the look of it, or they don't like that it grows in manure, or they don't like the taste of it. But those who accept it as a dietary item will be more successful at getting food, and consequently more successful at raising their offspring to sexual maturity. And that's the name of the game in Darwinian evolution. You must raise your offspring to sexual maturity. Then the genes flow forward. If you fail in that, you get an F in the evolution game. Well, okay, so visual acuity, that's all very fine. But psilocybin has other properties which build on that initial pharmacological peculiarity. If you take slightly larger doses of psilocybin, and this is typical of many indoles, you get, with many of which are hallucinogens, you get what is called CNS arousal, central nervous system arousal. You all know this feeling. It's the feeling of two double cappuccinos in short order. It's that you do not sleep, you are very restless, you are very alert, your attention is scanning, and in highly sexed animals like primates, arousal means exactly what it sounds like. It means erection in the male animal. And now, isn't that interesting? That is a second factor feeding back into this increased success with offspring business. Not only are you a better hunter, but you're a more highly sexed creature, and you're having more of what straight anthropologists refer to as successful copulations. An amazing phrase, actually. Meaning, of course, that impregnation is a consequence of these of this sexual activity. Now, the other thing that psilocybin does, at or slightly above this arousal level, and this is very important for the argument, is it causes what I call boundary dissolution, and boundary dissolution in human beings like you and me means ego loss. And I believe that this would have promoted a social and sexual style based not on monogamous pairing, but on orgy. The scenario is fairly easy to imagine. It's that these remote ancestors of ours would take these mushrooms, and they probably at the new and full moon, the thinking is that ritual was originally lunar timed, and then they would, and we're talking about nomadic groups of people, probably no more than 80 to 100 people, and then there would be group sexual activity. Now, an interesting social consequence of orgiastic social styles, besides a whole lot of fun, of course, is it's impossible to trace lines of male paternity in that kind of a situation. You see, women know whose children are whose because they see the child come out of their body and they nurse the child. But men do not, in that situation, have their children, my children. What they have are our children, the tribal group. And this boundary-dissolving thing, let's dwell on this for a moment, because this is central to my argument, and it has political consequences for our own lives. All primates, clear back down into squirrel monkeys and lemurs, all primates have what are called male dominance hierarchies. And what this means is that the males with the longest claws, the hardest muscles, and the meanest dispositions take control of everybody else. Women, children, weaker males, everybody comes under the thumb of the alpha males of the pack. This is true, as I said, of squirrel monkeys, howler monkeys, so forth and so on. It is also true of us sitting here in this room. This is a male dominance society. I mean, there's a lot of complaining and hair pulling about it, and there's a political alternative in the form of the women's movement and feminist sensitivities. But for most people, male dominance is the rule. Well, I would like to suggest that our peculiarly discomforted relationship to reality is a consequence of the fact that for a long period of time, perhaps as short as 20,000 years, perhaps as long as a million years, as a species, and not consciously, we accepted into our diet a drug that had the consequences of suppressing male dominance. That this was the social consequence of accepting psilocybin into the diet. The ego is a structure that forms in the psyche like a calcareous tumor or a growth. If you do not have regular recourse to the cure, and the cure is psilocybin and the boundary-dissolving sexual and social style which it carried in its wake. So the reason that we, as a people, are haunted by the idea of a lost paradise, a perfect world sometime in the misty past, is not, you know, Mircea Eliade called it the nostalgia for paradise and thought it was a kind of a longing that had no basis. But I think that it's entirely a memory of a period when male dominance was chemically suppressed, ego was chemically suppressed. And by male dominance and ego, I don't mean to lay this entirely on men. I mean, I would wager probably everyone in this room has more ego than they need, certainly starting with me. I mean, that's part of the paradox that you're supposed to enjoy in this, is, you know, the ambiguity of me preaching the loss of ego. So, essentially, you know, what happened was a chemically driven leap in evolution as a consequence of the suppression of these behaviors that favored male dominance. As a species, we would have continued with male dominance forever had it not been for psilocybin in the diet. And it established a situation in which in less than 2 million years, the human brain size doubled. This is, without contest, the greatest mystery in the whole of evolutionary theory. Lumsden, who is a brilliant evolutionary biologist, called the doubling of the human brain size in 2 million years the most spectacular transformation of a major organ of a higher animal in the entire fossil record. Well, now, it would be spectacular enough if it were the liver of an otter or the pancreas of an elephant. But notice that it is the organ which created the theory of evolution itself and all other theories. So that we're getting a little tautological here, folks. There's something fishy going on. What was it that caused this explosive doubling in human brain size? Well, I maintain that it was the new behaviors that emerged with the suppression of ego and their reinforcement in this situation of nomadic pastoralism. And that there was a period, let's call it from the melting of the last glaciers in Tel Chattalhyayuk, 6,500 BC, there was a period when men and women were in balance with each other, children and adults were at peace with each other, and human beings and the planet were at peace with each other. And then it was lost. And we fell into history. You know, the long slog toward Armageddon is what was initiated in its place. Well, now, if it was so wonderful, why would anybody ever let go of it? Why was it lost? Well, we have to go back to the very forces which created this situation. Remember, I said it was the climatological dynamics of the planet created the grasslands in place of the rainforest. Continuation of those processes turned those grasslands into desert. And where there once were water holes, running rivers, grasslands, and vast herds of animals and their human symbiotes, suddenly there was encroaching desert, fewer water holes. The mushrooms began to be seasonal, began to be located only in the rain shadows of mountains. The great mushroom festivals, which had been at the new and full moon, became solstitial, and then equinoctial, and then, you know, biennial or something. Anyway, you get the picture. It was fading. And I don't think people took this lying down. No pun intended. I think that there was great anxiety about the fading of the mushroom and the loss of the sacrament. And so these people searched for a strategy for preservation. Well, in a world without refrigeration, there is only one, well, no, there are two strategies for preservation of a delicate food like that. One is air drying, which is not terribly satisfying because as soon as a rain cloud comes along, your dry stuff absorbs moisture out of the air and turns yuck. And so the only real option is preservation in honey. And this was done, I'm sure. It's still done in Mexico to this day in remote mushroom-using villages. People preserve it in honey. Now, the problem here, and this is a lot, my book goes into this kind of thing a lot, because Food of the Gods, because what Food of the Gods is really about are the hidden factors that drugs lay upon us that we are not even aware of. And if you are attempting to preserve a hallucinogenic mushroom in honey, what you have to be aware of is that honey itself is potentially a psychoactive drug. Honey will turn into mead. It will ferment into a crude kind of honeyed alcohol. Well, if the mushroom brings suppression of ego, group sexual activity, and the formation of group values, what does alcohol bring? Alcohol has two effects primarily. It lowers sensitivity to social cueing at the same time that it confers an exaggerated sense of verbal facility. In other words, people turn into jerks behind this. I mean, you only have to go to a busy singles bar somewhere here in Boulder and you will see the alcohol ambiance being acted out right in front of you. So, and you know, it's perhaps not so true of our generation, but I think probably for 1,000 years nobody got laid in Western civilization unless they were juiced, because Christianity was laying such a heavy trip on everybody, and you know, people barely took their clothes off. In other words, you had to become blindly intoxicated to do what comes naturally. And I think up until very recently, how many women have their first sexual imprinting in an atmosphere of alcohol abuse? I mean, I would, some huge percentage, I imagine. So that is the story, basically, of the fall into history. The loss of this mushroom cult happened right at the time that we were inventing agriculture. And agriculture and the suppression of orgy have something in relationship to each other on two unrelated levels. First of all, you suppress orgy because once you have agriculture, it's no more about psyching yourself up for the great hunt. It's all about getting up before dawn and going out and hoeing the weeds out of the crops. So it doesn't promote a party mentality. The other thing is that as human mental capacity was evolving, remember that exploding brain size, as human mental capacity was evolving, women in these nomadic groups began to notice a curious fact, which was every year they would return roughly to the same places they had been the year before. And in the discards from last year's camp in the midden, they would discover food plants growing. And some brilliant woman or group of women put it together and said, aha, we buried food here last year, and now there is food here. Must be something about putting food into the ground gets you food. In other words, they were able to cognize a cause and effect relationship that were separated over many months of time. At the same time that women were putting this together, men were noticing that the act of sex had certain consequences 9 months later. The same perception had different impacts on both sexes, but it was an ability to coordinate a temporally separated cause and effect. Well, once men got onto the notion of male paternity, they realized that these aren't our children. Some are mine. Some are somebody else's. And from that notion, you go to my child, to my woman, to my hunting area, to my weapons, to my sib group. You get it all, you see. The ego is born, and it is born in an atmosphere of complete paranoia. The first consequence of agriculture, well, it has a number of consequences, but one consequence is it's a tremendously efficient way of producing food. That's obviously why people got into it. What does efficiency mean? Surplus. What does surplus mean? Haves and have-nots. The most spectacular architectural edifice of 10,000 BC on this planet was the grain tower at Jericho. It was had thick walls to hold the grain, and it had high walls so you could climb up on top of it and drop rocks on the people who were trying to get into it. The surplus makes nomadism impossible because you can't drag this huge amount of grain with you. So you get sedentary populations. And then, since the people who want the grain are killing your people in fury when they can't get the grain, you decide to put a wall around the whole encampment. Now you have a small town. Now you have urbanism. Now you have the division between nature and secular society. You have classes. You've got it all. And I maintain that this is the long march into hell. And our particular obsession with drugs as a species, I maintain, can be traced back to this transition. That, you know, yes, elephants love fermented papayas, and so do butterflies, and so forth and so on, but this kind of intoxication is not what we're about. We addict severely to several dozen substances, less severely to probably 100 more, and we addict to everything. This, you know, what we call romantic love shows a lot of similarities to hard drug addiction when you separate the lovers. You know, sleeplessness, suicidal tendencies, bursting into tears, hysteria, loss of weight. You can't tell whether this person is getting off heroin or has separated from their partner. Well, if you take an individual who is alcoholic or has some kind of serious drug problem, current thinking is this can be traced to traumatic abuse in childhood. This is what happened to us. Traumatic abuse in childhood. We were literally torn out of a symbiotic relationship to the earth by the forces of male dominance, agriculture, sedentary living, so forth and so on. And we've been trying to scratch an itch that we can't find ever since. And it has, you know, money doesn't do it, power doesn't do it, nothing seems to do it. We seem to be the unhappy monkey. And we take this unhappiness out on each other with a vengeance. And you see, what happened was when the mushroom faded, the million years of pharmacologically interrupted patterns of male dominance reasserted themselves. But it was no more a foraging monkey with this style. It was a creature with language, tools, music, social organization, and suddenly it got very ugly. And people weren't interested. People began fighting over the women. So we don't want to have orgies anymore. This woman is my woman. Touch her, you die, and so forth and so on. And we are living out the legacy of this. Well, before I talk about the social consequences of it for us, I want to go back to the question, what was so great about it? I mean, we've talked about orgy, but you can have orgy without psilocybin. What was so wonderful about that proto-historical mode? Well, this is where it becomes slightly more woo-woo. Because what we have to talk about is, what is the psychedelic experience anyway? And I maintain that if we're talking about psilocybin and we're talking about taking it in nature as these people did, that, you know, yes, first come the dancing mice, the little candies, the colored grids, and so forth and so on. But what eventually happens quickly, like 10 minutes later, is there is an entity in the trance, in the vision. There is a mind there waiting that speaks good English and invites you up into its room. And once there, you realize that this is what all the hoopla about the Gaian mind and the rebirth of the goddess and all that is about. It's not a metaphor, folks. It's a headline in biology. We are not the only intelligent-minded species occupying this planet. We may be the only bipedal hairless mammal with intelligence on this planet, but there is something out there spread through the grasses, the forests, the rivers, and the oceans. Our own emergence into intelligence took less than 2 million years. Life has been on this planet for 1.5 billion years, and we don't know how many strange pathways beckon, but at some point, a kind of mind came into existence, and it is real. It's what lies behind the religious impulse in our species. There really is somebody else sharing the local mind space. And I don't believe we're talking theology here. In other words, this is not, you know, in Milton's wonderful phrase, the God who hung the stars like lamps in heaven. It's not about that. For me, that's a big question mark. But it is the God, goddess of this earth. It is the biological mind. It is that all boundaries are illusions, and that life is a thinking, feeling entelechy of some sort. And we are just like a little droplet that has somehow escaped from the river of cognition and now imagine that we're the only water in the cosmos. Not so, it turns out. What the reason the psychedelic experience is so baffling and transformative, even as we sit here with your heads full of Heidegger and Husserl and, I don't know, Wilson Phillips and all this stuff, is because in the face, in contact with that, we have no more sophistication than our orgiastic mushroom-munching ancestors.